Could be. She shifted restlessly. You want to go back inside? Why? Said Stranahan. Is the sun going down? I can tell because it's getting cooler. Is it pretty tonight? The sun said.
I've never seen a bad one.
Joey said, Tomorrow the towel comes off and I finally get to find out what you look like. I'm guessing a middle-aged Clint Eastwood.
Then you're in for a major disappointment.
But you're tall, right? She said. Late 40s?
Early 50s.
Gray around the temples?
You want another beer?
Not just yet, Joey said. Give me your hands again.
Stranahan laughed. I don't think so. They're awful fishy.
You eat with your fingers. I like that.
My table manners aren't what they used to be, he said. Comes from living alone, I guess.
Joey said, How many times have you been married? I know it's incredibly rude to ask, but, well, I've got a hunch.
6, Stranahan said. 6 times. He stood up and began gathering the plates off the table.
Jesus, I was going to guess 3.
See, I'm full of surprises.
What happened? Joey asked. But all she got in reply was the bang of the screen door.
Moments later, she heard a running tap and the clink of dishes in the sink. When Stranahan came back outside, she apologized.
What for? He said. Being so nosy. I figured you must be pissed, since you slammed that door.
Nah, the hinges are rusted to hell is all.
He placed a cool bottle in her hand.
But it's true. 6 ex-wives is nothing to brag about.
At least none of them tried to murder you, Joey said.
One came pretty close.
Really? She go to jail?
Nope. Died.
Joey's breath seemed to catch in her throat. She took a long, unsteady slug of beer. Stranahan said,
Relax, honey, I didn't kill her.
Who was she?
When I met her, a waitress. Just like the rest of them.
Joey couldn't help but giggle.
You married 6 waitresses?
Actually, it was 5. The last one was a TV producer.
Oh, Mick!
And they were all fairly wonderful at the start. Whatever went wrong was usually my fault.
But what in the world were you thinking? I mean, honestly, by the time you got to number 6...
Oh, I wasn't thinking, Stranahan said. Love isn't about thinking. You should know that.
Joey Perone leaned back and turned her draped face toward the fading light.
The sky out there. I bet it's all pink and gold.
God, I must look like a horror with this blindfold.
Is Chaz your first husband?
2nd. The 1st one died. She added quickly, in an accident.
That sucks.
He was a stockbroker. Chaz is a biologist.
Stranahan said, The no-see-ums are chewing you up. Let's go back inside.
Funny. The only time my eyes really hurt is when I cry, she said. If only I could stop.
Come on. Take my hand.
No. I like it out here. The bugs don't bother me.
Joey gave a defiant sniffle.
And listen. It's not that son of a bitch Chaz Perone that I'm bawling about. I'm 99% sure I didn't even love him anymore.
Stranahan said nothing. He was an expert on dying relationships. The grinding hollowness that sets in until someone makes a move.
But what Chaz did out there, she went on, pointing at the water, it just hacks me off royally. You've got no idea.
Yeah, I do, Stranahan thought.
The question was hanging there, so he went ahead and asked. Then what's making you cry?
Oh, I suppose it's realizing that my whole life adds up to this one moment and this one place and this one...
She swept an arm angrily.
Stinking, lousy situation. No offense, Mick, but half-blind on an island with some stranger isn't really where I expected to be at this point in time. This isn't the shape I expected to find myself in at age 30-whatever.
Listen, you're going to be okay.
All right. After my fucking husband, pardon my French, threw me fucking overboard on our fucking anniversary cruise. How exactly does a woman put something like that behind her, huh? How does one get past that sort of personal setback?
Stranahan said, seeing him hauled off in handcuffs might help the healing. Why don't you let me call the police?
Joey shook her head so vehemently that he thought the towel might fly off. The trial, Mick, it's going to be a nightmare. My word against his. He'll probably say I got trashed and fell over the rail. That's what he already told the Coast Guard, I'm sure. 4 years ago, I got a dumb DUI up in Daytona, which Chaz's lawyers will dig up in 2 seconds flat. Kindly get up on the witness stand, Mrs. Perrone, and tell the court how your tennis pro boyfriend dumped you for a swimsuit model, so you drank a whole bottle of Cabernet and parked your car in the middle of A1A and went to sleep. Okay, calm down. But I'm right, aren't I? My word against his.
Stranahan allowed that things could get ugly in court. It's none of my business, Joey. But is there money involved? Would Chaz have gotten rich if you'd died?
Nope. Not even life insurance? None that I know of, Joey said. Now you see why I'm so, I don't know, dazed. Him trying to kill me doesn't make sense. He wanted a divorce, all he had to do was say so.
She asked Stranahan what he would do in her place. Take off the wedding ring, for starters, he said. Joey sheepishly tugged the platinum band off her finger and palmed it.
Then what?
I'd go straight to the cops, Stranahan said, wondering what other options she might be contemplating. He decided not to ask as a breeze kicked up and seemed to carry away Joey's anger.
You're smiling. That's good, he said.
Because it's wet and it tickles.
What tickles?
Mick, please tell me it's the dog.
Stranahan peeked under the table. Strom, you're a very bad boy, he said, reaching for the Doberman's collar.
Guess he likes me.
Joey said with an acid chuckle. But they all act that way at first. Detective Carl Rolvag belonged in the Midwest. This he knew in his heart, and he was reminded of it every day when he went to work. Practically anywhere in the upper Midwest would have been fine, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, or even the Dakotas. There the crimes were typically forthright and obvious, ignited by common greed, lust, or alcohol. Florida was more complicated and extreme, and nothing could be assumed. Every scheming shitwad in America turned up here sooner or later. Such were the opportunities for predation.
I don't much care for Mr. Perrone, Rolvag remarked to his captain.
Already? The captain's name was Gallo. He was fond of Rolvag because Rolvag made him look good by closing many difficult cases, though socially the detective wasn't exactly a barrel of laughs.
You think he pushed her? Gallo asked. Not like we could ever prove it if he did.
Rolvag shrugged. I just don't care for him is all. They were having coffee at a truck stop diner on Road 84. It was nearly midnight, and Rolvag was in a hurry to go deal with the rats that might or might not be scampering loose inside his car.
The dead wife, Gallo said. Tell me again how much she's worth.
$13 million, give or take. The trust officers are working up some numbers.
But hubby's not in line for a penny, right?
Not even life insurance? Asked Gallo. Not that I can find, but it's still early in the game.
Be awful dumb for him to lie about something like that.
I agree. Rolvag snuck a glance at his wristwatch. It had been 6 hours since he'd left the pet store. He hoped the rats hadn't nibbled a hole in the shoebox.
What's the next of kin say about young Chaz? Gallo asked.
Mrs. Perrone's parents are deceased, and her only brother lives on a sheep farm in New Zealand. Gallo frowned.
Christ, that's an expensive phone call. Try to keep it short and sweet.
You betcha. Rolvag sometimes lapsed into Fargo speak when Gallo nagged him about something stupid. The detective had moved to Fort Lauderdale from St. Paul because his wife had inexplicably yearned to experience humidity. A decade later, she was back in the Twin Cities, and Rolvag was still in Florida, divorced and sweating like a hog for 11.5 months of the year. However, tucked in his briefcase was salvation in the form of a letter from the police chief in Edina, Minnesota, a pleasantly civilized suburb of Minneapolis. The police chief had offered Rolvag a job working major crimes, of which there were few. Rolvag intended to give his notice to Captain Gallo as soon as an opening in the conversation presented itself. "And I suppose nobody on the cruise ship saw or heard a damn thing," Gallo was saying. "Pretty girl goes over the side and everybody's snoozing." Without a trace of sarcasm, Rolvag explained that he hadn't had time to interview all 2,048 other passengers or the crew, but nobody's come forward either, he added. Gallo twirled a set of car keys on the pinky finger of his right hand. "And the Coast Guard? They're done?" "As of tomorrow noon, yeah. They'll keep one chopper up until sunset, but that's mainly for show," Rolvag said. "Is hubby real upset or what?"
"He says all the right things, but it's like he memorized a script."
Gallo smiled crookedly.
"Carl, even if she floats up somewhere, yeah, I know, unless her neck's been wrung or he capped her in the noodle, right, we can't prove a thing. You got a babe stash somewhere?"
"I'm checking on that."
"But let's say he does."
"I know. It doesn't automatically mean he killed the wife." Rolvag was aware that Gallo, having several girlfriends himself, could be somewhat defensive on the subject of adulterers.
"But you don't believe Perron, I can tell," Gallo said.
"I don't believe we're getting the whole story about his marriage, no." Gallo laughed.
"Carl, you ain't never gonna get that. Not from any husband, including yours truly."
"But your wife isn't missing at sea."
"This one's bugging you, isn't it? I know, 'cause you got that Norwegian Prince of Gloom look on your face."
Rolvag forced a smile. "It's just another case," he said, which was not really how he felt about it.
"You still got all those giant snakes?"
the captain asked. "Just the two, yeah. They're only 7-footers.
Are you still feeding them those fucking rats?"
"They won't eat stir-fry, unfortunately."
"I can't believe the condo commandos haven't evicted you yet."
"They keep trying," Rolvag said. Most of his neighbors in the building owned small dogs and were terrified of the possibility of Rolvag's pythons escaping. His legal costs already had surpassed $6,000.
"Christ, Carl, they're fucking reptiles. Why don't you just get rid of the damn things?"
"I like them."
"More important, do they like you?"
"We get along fine. In return for food and shelter, they give me unconditional indifference." Gallo said he knew a topless dancer in Oakland Park who would be thrilled to have the snakes for her stage act.
"She'd give them a good home, too. The kind we all dream about."
"Thanks anyway," Rolvag stood up. "I'd better get going before those damn rodents hotwire my car."
"You're one bent penny," Gallo said, not unkindly. "Let's wrap up Mrs. Perron by Friday, okay?"
"Friday?
Hey, they can't all be winners, Carl. Some cases there's only so much you can do."
"Especially in 6 days," Rolvag thought irritably. He said, "One thing her husband told me, she was a star swimmer back in college."
"Yeah, well, I seriously doubt she practiced diving off ocean liners or swimming with sharks. Give it till Friday, Carl. You can keep the file open, but let's slide it to the bottom of the pile."
"You betcha." Later, driving home with the box of rats, Rolvag remembered the letter in his briefcase. He was miffed at himself for not mentioning it to Gallo, so that the captain could begin processing the paperwork for Rolvag's resignation. "First thing Monday," the detective vowed. He was looking forward to getting out of this steaming sump and moving back to Minnesota. He truly was. 5. Charles Regis Perrone was a biologist by default. Medical school had been his first goal, specifically a leisurely career in radiology. The promise of wealth had attracted him to healthcare, but as a devoted hypochondriac, he was repelled by the idea of interacting with actual sick people. Perusing X-rays in the relatively hygienic seclusion of a laboratory had seemed an appealing option, one that would leave plenty of time for recreation. Chaz's master plan was derailed by his own lubricious appetites. During those pre-med years, he spent more time in condoms than he did in the stacks, and consequently meandered through the University of Florida with a less than dazzling 2.1 GPA. Not many medical schools avidly pursue C students, but Chaz wasn't crushed. He'd already decided that being a doctor would cut too onerously into his social schedule, and that he would devise another way to get rich. In the meantime, he sailed forth into the world armed with his Ken doll good looks, his priapic affability, and a bachelor's degree in a subject he loathed, biology. 3 months after graduation, he reluctantly moved back home with his mother, whose new husband, an addled ex-RAF pilot named Roger, delighted in tormenting Chaz with odd pranks. Whenever he snuck into a bathroom to whack off, which was several times a day, Roger would turn up the Irish Rovers full blast, rap on the door jamb, and chant, "Bad monkey! Bad monkey!" in an eerie falsetto. Chaz suffered under his mother's roof. But without a job, there seemed no escape. Only one prospective employer had displayed a glint of interest in his college credentials, the Bay County Humane Society, which was looking for just the right person to hose down the kennels twice a day. It dawned on Chaz that he was doomed to minimum wage hell, unless he obtained a master's degree, so he purchased one from a popular diploma mill in Colorado. The 8-week mail-order course guaranteed graduation, with honors, for a fee of $999, which Chaz remorselessly conned from his mother. Any topic vaguely related to biology was acceptable for a thesis paper, double spacing being the only academic requirement. Chaz's opus, researched one afternoon in the produce section of the local supermarket, was titled "A Comparative Analysis of Late-Season Oranges, Ruby Grapefruits, and Tangelos." 10 days after mailing off the finished manuscript, a cashier's check clipped to the cover page as required, he received a certified letter stating that the school had been shut down, stripped of its accreditation, and evicted from the strip mall where its campus had been headquartered. Grudgingly, Chaz accepted the fact that he might have to physically attend classes in order to secure an advanced degree. His mother, having stumbled upon the more unsavory elements of his porn collection, expedited his departure by imposing on a cousin who taught at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Although Chaz's GRE scores were nearly as forgettable as his grades, the politesse of nepotism prevailed, and he was admitted to the master's program. It was a buoyant and eager postgraduate who arrived at the Rosenstiel campus on Virginia Key, for he had grandly envisioned himself sailing the lazy tropics on a schooner, tracking pods of playful bottlenose dolphins. In this fantasy, Chaz held binoculars in one hand and a frosty margarita in the other. Had he bothered to scan the curriculum in advance, he would not have been so poleaxed by the tedious reality of field biology. His first assignment was assisting a doctoral candidate in a study of coastal sea lice, an experience that reignited Chaz's antipathy toward the great outdoors and all denizens great and small. Among his chores was collecting gobs of algal weed that harbored the tiny granular organisms, which were not true lice, but rather the larvae of Lanuki unguiculata, the thimble jellyfish. Chaz's initial aversion to his subject was justified on the second day, when the pest somehow burrowed beneath his wetsuit and colonized his upper torso with an itchy pustular rash, a painful condition, spectacularly exacerbated by an ill-advised choice of colognes. Before the first semester was half over, Chaz looked like he'd been dragged from a burning oil rig. He stiffly informed his faculty supervisor that the only sensible purpose for studying sea lice was to isolate a toxin that would wipe them off the face of the earth. Clearly, Chaz had neither the hide nor the perspective required for scientific inquiry. Worse, he had no interest whatsoever in the lesser species. As an undergraduate, he had muddled through classroom biology by memorizing just enough to pass the exams. In the field, he couldn't fake it so easily. The work was sweltering, repetitive, and just plain hard. Every time Chaz asked if he could go play with dolphins, he was told to fetch another tub of kelp. His family connections spared Chaz the ignominy of flunking out. Instead, he was steered along a path of study that minimized his exposure to nature, the breeding cycle of captive mosquito fish. After 2 years of sullenly tending aquariums, he emerged with a marginal M.A. in marine biology. At graduation, the entire Rosenstiel faculty rose as one to cheer Chaz as he crossed the stage. So elated were they to see the last of him. To his own surprise, he had no sooner laminated his diploma than he was offered a job. The company was a famous cosmetics manufacturer that conveniently had no use for the oceanic sciences and no concern about Chaz's lackluster grade. The firm merely needed a presentable face on staff, what serious biologists scornfully referred to as a biostitute, who would dutifully attest that its perfume products contained only negligible levels of toxins, acetones, and carcinogens. Recruiters for the cosmetics company were impressed by Chaz's fastidious grooming and handsome features, which they felt would enhance his effectiveness as an expert witness, especially among female jurors. He was assigned to the company's Jacksonville plant, where he was given an office, a small laboratory, and a starter batch of 100 white mice. These he occasionally swabbed with Blue Passion, Shiver, or whatever new fragrance was being test-marketed at the time. Every now and then, a mouse would manifest a tumor the size of a kumquat, causing Chaz to snatch up the wretched critter with barbecue tongs and heave it into a culvert behind the building. The idea of scientifically documenting such malignancies was never contemplated. Charles Regis Perrone would not be laying his immaculate fingertips on diseased vermin, not for a lousy 38 grand a year. Then one morning, while shredding newspapers for the rodent cages, he spotted a headline that would change his destiny. Congress mulls $8 billion plan for Everglades restoration. Fortune appeared to Chaz in a mystical burst of green light. With a zeal that would have flabbergasted his former college professors, he embarked upon an ambitious research project that ultimately connected him with a person named Samuel Johnson Hammernut, known as Red to both friends and enemies. Hammernut's name had become familiar to Chaz through archived newspaper articles that alleged recurring atrocities against his fellow men, specifically immigrant farm workers, as well as the planet itself. At first, Red Hammernut had been wary of Chaz's audacious proposition, but soon he'd come around. It was he who was now phoning Chaz at 3 a.m. at the Marriott.
"What's this I heard?"
Red Hammernut barked from what sounded like a NASA wind tunnel. Chaz peered at the digital clock.
"Where are you?" he asked. "Africa, remember?"
Red Hammernut, in quest of a world-record tarpon, was calling from a satellite phone aboard a mothership somewhere off the coast of Gabon.
"So what's this about Joey?" he said. "Is it true?"
Chaz sat up in bed, suddenly alert.
"I'm afraid so, Red. We went on a cruise and she... well, she must have fallen off the ship. They can't find her anywhere." "Damn! How'd you know about it?" "It was in the Fort Lauderdale papers. Elizabeth faxed me the story," Red Hammernut said.
"But how'd you figure out where I was?"
"I called up that girl reporter and told her I was your uncle. Ha!"
"Oh." Chaz understood that this was not a sympathy call, such sentiment being alien to Red Hammernut's character. The man wanted information, and he also wanted to remind Chaz of his larger responsibilities.
"I don't know what happened," Chaz said carefully, in case Detective Rolvag was tapping the hotel line. "Joey went up on deck in the middle of the night, and she didn't come back. Nobody saw her go overboard, but that's the assumption."
"Why, sure. What the hell else could it be?"
Red Hammernut's voice whirled in the static.
"What a terrible fucking thing. Just terrible. Tell me, son. They still out searching for her? Coast Guard boys, I mean?"
"Until tomorrow at noon. Then they call it quits."
"Well, I'll be damned."
Chaz could picture the stumpy little cracker lounging in the cabin of the yacht, lapping at a tumbler of Jack Daniels. His freckled bowling pin legs would be sunburned to a bright pink, and the sea breeze would have made a comedy of his sparse, coppery comb-over. The round, white circles around Red's squinty eyes, caused by his absurdly oversized Polaroids, would present the visage of an irradiated lemur.
"You need anything, Chaz. Anything at all," Red Hammernut said. "I can have 6 private choppers in the air at dawn, that's what you want. We'll do our own goddamn search and rescue."
Anxiously, Chaz wondered how many drinks Red had guzzled. "That's very generous," he told him. "But they've been up and down the coast a dozen times. They'd have found her by now, don't you think? The water's full of sharks."
"Oh, man," Red Hammernut said. "You hear all that noise?"
"Sure do," Chaz said.
"Rough as a cob out here. It's got to be blowing 30 knots.
"You be careful."
"Hell, son, ain't she even going to ask about the fishing?"
"Right. How's it going?" Chaz sensed it was time to wrap up the chat before Red abandoned all pretense of genuine concern.
"Sucks doggy schlongs, that's how it's going. 4 days and we haven't jumped one topping over 100 pounds, Red Hammernut complained. "You're the ace marine scientist. What's the goddamn deal? Where's my fish?"
Chaz had no idea. "Maybe they're spawning," he said lamely. When Red Hammernut laughed, he sounded like a constipated mule.
"Spawning my ass! Don't tell me you needed a Ph.D. to come up with that one. A Ph.D. that I fucking paid for."
"Well, that wasn't my field of study." Chaz strained to conceal his annoyance.
"What's not your field?"
"Migratory game fish." Red Hammernut guffawed.
"That's too bad, 'cause I could use some honest-to-God expertise right now. This little operation's costing me about $3,000 a day."
"Then maybe you should have started with something small and dumb," Chaz felt like saying, "like perch." Red Hammernut had taken up sport fishing only 3 months earlier. "Maybe your luck'll change tomorrow," Chaz offered, but the crusty bastard couldn't lay off.
"I trust you know more about sharks than you do about topping," he said, "if you catch my drift."
The guy's unbelievable, Chaz thought, joking about what happened to Joey.
"I think we're losing the signal," Chaz shouted into the mouthpiece. "You take care of yourself, and we'll talk when you get back."
"For sure," Red Hammernut said. "Hey, I'm real sorry about the missus. A damn shame is what it is."
The little shit-kicker was trying to sound sincere, but Chaz wasn't fooled. The man had the heart of a scorpion.
"You be careful," Red added, in an unmistakable tone of warning. "You hear me? Be real damn careful. Am I coming through?"
"I hear you fine, Red." Joey Perrone awoke before sunrise and unwrapped the strip of towel from her head. Although her eyelids remained tender from the man-o'-war stings, her vision seemed clear. Quietly, she made her way to the bathroom, where she tried to ignore the blotched and bleary woman in the mirror. She had slept in an oversized Stanford jersey and a pair of white jogging shorts that had belonged to one of Mick Stranahan's ex-wives, the television producer. When Joey had inquired how long that particular marriage had lasted, he'd said, "Depends who you ask."
Gingerly, she washed her face, then managed to gargle without making a peep. Afterward, she hunted through the vanity and found a rubber band for her hair. Stranahan was asleep, sprawled on a sofa in the living room. Joey tiptoed up to him and leaned as close as she dared. In the half-light, she studied his features and smiled. Not bad, she thought. I knew it. She stopped in the kitchen to grab two apples and a ripe banana. Slipping out the back, she was careful to close the screen door softly. Strom lifted his head when she stepped barefoot onto the dock. Joey stroked his muzzle and whispered, "You're a handsome fella. Maybe someday mean old Mick will find you a girlfriend." As she climbed aboard the skiff, Joey was thinking, "This is really rude. The least I could have done was leave him a note." She untied the ropes and shoved off. As the boat slid lightly away, Joey sat down at the wheel, peeled the banana, and waited. She didn't want to crank up the engine too near the island and awaken Stranahan. She felt guilty enough about the way she was leaving. Inside the steering console was Stranahan's telephone, plugged in with a charger cord. That meant he'd have no way to call the authorities when he discovered his skiff was gone. Again, Joey felt lousy, but keeping Mick incommunicado would give her some extra time to do what she had to do. As the boat drifted away, she finished the banana and placed the peel under the seat. In an aft hatch, she located the fuel primer bulb and squeezed it until it was hard in her fist. She knew something about outboards. Years earlier, she had taught her first husband to water ski, and together they'd bought an aquasport, powered with a 150-horse Yamaha. Stranahan's boxy old Evinrude started on the third try. Joey nudged the throttle forward and checked over her shoulder. There was no sign of Mick, but the Doberman was watching her from the end of the dock, his ears pricked and his butt wiggling excitedly. She waved at the dog, then took off toward the Miami skyline.
"Not again," Stranahan muttered, kicking at a fallen coconut.
He sat down at the picnic table with a cup of coffee, Strom settling at his feet. Joey wasn't the first woman to take off with Stranahan's skiff, but she was the first he hadn't already slept with, lived with, and then driven away in a state of exasperation. When they made up their minds to go, melodrama seemed mandatory. The last one to try the same stunt had been a successful patent attorney named Susan. She had professed to adore the isolation of the island, but in fact she was going batty because she couldn't uplink her BlackBerry, whatever the hell that meant, due to unspecified atmospheric anomalies. Possibly other factors contributed to her restlessness as well, Stranahan had concluded afterward. One evening at sunset, Susan snapped. After lacing Stranahan's rum and coke with Ambien, she packed her bags, boosted his boat, and promptly piled into the submerged rocks off the Ragged Keys. She cracked not only her collarbone, but the shaft on the Evinrude, which set Stranahan back $1,800.
"For God's sake, why didn't you just ask me to give you a lift?" he'd said to her later in the emergency room.
"Because I didn't want to upset you," she'd replied. "I know how you are." That's what they all said. "I know how you are." And usually they were mistaken. They didn't really know him at all. But since Stranahan wasn't much good at revealing his sensitive inner self, the women who took an interest couldn't be blamed for misreading the signs. The Susan incident had cast him into a mood of frank introspection, but in the meantime he'd taken steps to protect his humble vessel from future hijackings by disgruntled companions. With a hunting scope, he easily located Joey Perrone, adrift less than 2 miles from the island. "Want to come along?" he asked Strom, who declined in favor of licking his privates. Stranahan dragged the yellow ocean kayak from the shed and pushed it into the water. He stripped off his shirt, kicked away his flip-flops, and climbed in. He paddled through the light chop with short, hard strokes, and the burn in his shoulders felt good. With the wind behind him, he reached the disabled skiff in 20 minutes. Joey sat on the bow with her legs dangling. She said, "Twice in 3 days. How lame is that?" Stranahan pulled himself aboard and secured the kayak to a cleat on the stern.
This one definitely doesn't count as a rescue, he said. This is purely a fuck-up.
Mick, I wasn't stealing the boat, honest. He opened one of the front hatches and with some effort inserted his head and arms inside. I was going to leave it tied up at dinner quay, Joey insisted. Look, I didn't mean to break the darn thing. I'll pay for the damage, okay?
From below, he said, what makes you think it's broken?
No?
Actually, it's working perfectly.
He got up, wiped his palms on his khakis, and stepped back to the console. The instant he turned the key, the engine rumbled to life. Peevishly, Joey asked, how'd you do that?
I've got a manual valve on the fuel line near the tank. Last night I shut it off, he said. Force of habit, I guess.
A cut-off valve.
Exactly. Whatever gas was left in the hose, that's all you had to run on this morning, he explained. And that's why the engine crapped out.
Clever.
Joey was working her lower jaw. See, I've had my boat swiped before.
That doesn't surprise me.
Stranahan motioned her away from the bow. She moved to the ice cooler and assumed a slump-shouldered pose, watching him as he spun the steering wheel. He said, I can't blame you for being disappointed. You were expecting the pale rider, and all you got was me. Joey rolled her eyes.
Stranahan took it easy on the trip back to the island, the kayak bouncing lightly in the backwash of the skiff. Leaning sideways, he said,
I would have gladly taken you to the mainland myself. What the hell were you thinking?
I was thinking you're probably going to call the Coast Guard or the police regardless, and that's not what I want.
Where were you going?
To surprise my husband. To enjoy the look on his face when he saw I was still alive.
And then what? Let him try to murder you again?
So maybe it wasn't the smartest idea I've ever had, Joey said. I'm just so damn furious. I was going to wait till he was taking a shower and then sneak in the bathroom and yank open the curtain. I thought maybe I could give him a heart attack.
Great scene, Stranahan said, but not a great plan.
I thought of a better one. Want to hear it?
Nope, he said.
It came to me all of a sudden while I was floating around out here in your boat, she said. I think you'll approve.
Doubtful, said Stranahan, and for what it's worth, I keep my promises. There was no need to run away. I wasn't going to call the cops until you were ready.
Joey tugged the rubber band out of her ponytail. What if I'm never ready?
That's the new plan. You want everybody to keep on thinking you're dead?
Mainly my homicidal shitbird of a husband.
Stranahan played along. And this is so you can disappear to some place far away, right? Take a new name, start a new life.
Oh, no, Joey said. This is so I can ruin his.
Ah, sweet revenge.
Justice is a better word for it.
Please, Stranahan laughed. She was a fireball, this one. Joey, what about your folks and your family, your friends? You really want to put them through that sort of agony?
She informed him that her parents were dead and that her only brother lived on the other side of the world. Him, I'll tell, she said. He'll be cool with it.
And your boss? The people you work with?
I quit my job when I got married, she said. Also, you might as well know I've got money. A ridiculous amount. More than enough to do what I have in mind for Chaz.
Christ, you're serious.
Of course. I'm surprised you can't understand. Joey turned away, raising an arm to shield her eyes from the sun.
When they pulled up to the dock, Strom wet himself in exuberance. Stranahan tied off the skiff, stowed the kayak, and went inside to make omelets. Joey changed into somebody's yellow sundress and an oversized straw hat.
Breakfast, which included fresh-squeezed grapefruit juice, was served on the deck under partly cloudy sky.
Stranahan waited until they were done before finishing his lecture. Listen to me, please. You can't kill your husband and get away with it, he said, just because everybody thinks you're dead. That kind of nonsense only happens in the movies.
She peered from under the brim of the immense hat, her expression one of broad amusement.
Mick, I don't want to kill Chaz Perrone. I just want to screw with him until he screws himself. Can't you see the possibilities?
Stranahan was alarmed to find himself intrigued by the idea. He hoped Joey wouldn't notice. She sat forward intently. Has anyone seriously tried to murder you? Tell the truth.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
And what did you do about it?
That was different, Joey. I was in law enforcement.
Triumphantly, she banged her hands flat on the table.
I knew it! I friggin' knew it!
Was, Stranahan said. Long, long time ago. Answer the question, Mick. What did you do to the guy who tried to murder you? He took a slow breath before answering.
I killed them.
She sat back as forcefully as if she'd been shoved.
Wow, she said.
Want a papaya?
Them?
You're talking dead guys, plural?
I was in the military, too, Stranahan said. Be right back.
He went to the kitchen and returned with two bagels and a platter of glistening papaya slices.
Tell me everything, Joey said, her eyes shining.
Under no circumstances. Stranahan's two least favorite topics of chat were, in order, the women he'd married and the men he'd killed. Of the latter, Raleigh Goomer, the crooked judge, was the most well-known, although others had come before and after. All the killings were, by most moral standards, justified. From the North Vietnamese Army regulars he'd shot in a firefight, to the slow-footed hitman he'd impaled with the sword of a stuffed marlin. They made for colorful stories, Stranahan supposed, but none he wished to share with a young stranger. Joey said,
I guess I should be scared of you.
He shook his head.
Other way around.
I told you, Mick, I don't want to kill Chad. I can't even squish a darn palmetto bug without feeling guilty. But he needs to pay for what he did.
What have you got against prisons? Stranahan asked. Trust me, 10 years at Rayford will rock your husband's little world worse than anything you can dream up.
Joey popped a crescent of papaya into her mouth. Assuming he's convicted, she said, which ain't exactly a slam dunk, not without eyewitnesses, or at least a motive. Am I right?
There's got to be a motive, Joey. There's always a motive.
Look, I haven't got all the angles figured out, but let me tell you, Chaz is slicker than pig snot on a doorknob, or however the saying goes.
Close enough, Stranahan said.
The thought of me against him in court, it's too scary. I can't take that risk.
Stranahan appreciated Joey's misgivings. Trials in South Florida were famously unpredictable.
Before I met Chaz, he worked for a cosmetics company, she said. He was their big scientific hotshot, the one they'd trot in to testify how safe their perfumes were. He showed me a tape of himself on the witness stand, and you know what? He was good, Mick. I can totally see a jury buying his act.
Stranahan knew that he should tell her to trust the system, but he couldn't say the words with a straight face. He'd seen more than a few cold-blooded monsters stroll out of a courtroom scot-free.
So where do we stand? Joey asked him. What are you going to do with me now?
He was pondering a reply when he noticed a blaze-orange helicopter approaching low from the ocean.
Strom spotted it too and began barking insanely, leaping in circles. Joey's hat fell off when she tilted her head to see the aircraft, which flew directly over them and slowed to a hover. Stranahan could make out the Coast Guard spotter positioned at an open door. The man was wearing a white helmet and aiming binoculars, and almost certainly he was searching for Mrs. Charles Perrone, believed lost at sea. To end it, Stranahan had only to stand up, wave both arms, and point toward the woman in the yellow sundress, the one who had hastily ducked back under her floppy hat and was now eyeing him anxiously. How easy it would be, he thought. And how tempting, too, because, honestly, he was too old for this shit. Yet he didn't wave or point or signal to the chopper in any of the usual ways.
Instead, he reached for Joey's left hand and brought it to his lips, lightly but long enough for the Coast Guard spotter to see him do it, so that the searcher would conclude, as any observer might, that the woman in the sundress wasn't a castaway, but obviously the wife or girlfriend of the lucky middle-aged guy at the picnic table. And sure enough, the helicopter buzzed away. They watched until it was a bright dot in the soft blue distance. Satisfied that he'd done his job, Strom stopped barking and curled up. A flock of perturbed gulls materialized overhead. "Thank you," Joey Perrone said to Stranahan. "Does this mean I can stay?"
"I must be nuts," he said.
6. The call from the Coast Guard came at noon sharp. "I can't believe you're giving up," Chaz said. His bags had been packed for an hour. "My wife's out there in the water somewhere. What if she's still alive?"
"The odds are very slim. I'm sorry, Mr. Perrone."
Chaz checked out of the Marriott and drove home feeling relieved and emboldened. He had committed a flawless crime. 37 hours had passed since he'd heaved Joey overboard, and not so much as a single hair had been found. The ocean had done its job. Entering the house, Chaz experienced a wave of, what was it? Not remorse, but more of a carnal longing. The place smelled lightly of Joey's favorite perfume, a scent that never failed to arouse him. It was much more subtle than the fruity slop that Rika wore, Chaz thought. Maybe I can talk her into switching brands. He listened to a score of choked-up phone messages from friends of Joey who'd read about her disappearance in the paper. Chaz pondered his good fortune to have wed a woman with practically no family, extended or otherwise, to make a fuss. Chaz had never even met his wife's only brother, and he wondered if the news of Joey's death would dislodge the reclusive Corbett Wheeler from his beloved New Zealand. At first, the sight of Joey's clothes in the closet unsettled Chaz. He felt better after sweeping the hangers clean and better still after expunging the bathroom of all her soaps, creams, scrubs, moisturizers, exfoliants, lotions, and conditioners. Methodically, he went around gathering his wife's belongings and piling them on their king-sized bed. He took everything, except one intriguing lace bra and a pair of panties, which looked as if they might fit Rika, if she dropped a few pounds. Also exempt from removal was Joey's jewelry, worth at least 10 or 12 grand. Chaz had no containers large enough to hold all his wife's stuff, so he drove to the delivery bay of a nearby Brands Mart and scored some jumbo cardboard boxes. Upon returning, he saw a gray Ford sedan in his driveway and Carl Rolvog waiting on the front step. To avoid the appearance of embracing widowhood, another murderous spouse might have left the boxes in his car out of the jaded detective's sight. Chaz, however, was resolved not to let himself be intimidated or thrown off course. "What you got there?" Rolvog asked. "Is that one of those new Humvees?" Wordlessly, Chaz unlocked the front door and backed inside with the boxes. He went directly to the bedroom, the sallow cop following at a courteous distance.
"I just can't stand to see all her things here. It's just too damn painful," Chaz said.
He began tossing Joey's dresses and blouses into a box that had once held a 40-inch Sanyo.
"Everywhere I turn, there she is," he went on somberly. "I can't even bring myself to unpack her suitcase from the cruise."
Rolvog looked on thoughtfully. "Everyone reacts different to a shock like this. Some people, they won't touch anything in the house. They leave every single item exactly as it was before, and I mean everything. Linens, dirty laundry. You'd be amazed. Won't even throw out their loved one's toothbrush. They keep it standing in a cup by the sink. Sometimes for years this goes on." Chaz continued to fill the box. "Not me. All these things to remind me, I'd be too depressed to get out of bed."
"What are you going to do with all of it?"
"I haven't decided. Give it to charity, maybe?"
The detective reached in and picked up a tortoiseshell hairbrush. "May I take this?" "Be my guest," Chaz said automatically. Then, after a moment's thought, "Can I ask what for?" "Just in case." "Yeah?" "In case something turns up later," Rolvag said. "A body part or whatever. I don't mean to be graphic, Mr. Perrone, but it occasionally happens." "Oh, I see. You want a sample of Joey's DNA?" "That's right. The hair on this brush should be enough to establish a match, if necessary," the detective said. "Do you mind?" "Course not." Without missing a beat, Chaz snatched a couple of purses off the bed and dropped them into the box. Rolvag slipped Joey's brush into an inside pocket of his suit jacket. He said, "There have been incidents here in Florida where a fisherman hauls in some huge shark, and it's flopping around the deck of the boat, and all of a sudden it regurgitates part of a human body. And this can be, like, weeks after the person has gone missing. Meantime, the shark might have swum 200 or 300 miles. Chaz interrupted with a queasy grimace. "I get the picture." "Sorry, Mr. Perrone. You probably studied cases like that at Rosensteel." Chaz's gaze flickered briefly from the box to the detective's face. "Yes, we did." He heard an edginess in his own voice. Rolvag had been checking up on him. "Take whatever you need," Chaz offered, motioning toward the pile of Joey's things. "I'm willing to do anything if there's a chance to bring closure." The detective gave a smile that Chaz chose to read as sympathetic. "Closure would be good," Rolvag said. "Painful sometimes, but still a step forward. I'm sorry to have intruded on your privacy." Chaz walked him to the door and said, "The Coast Guard called. They quit searching at noon." "Yes, I know." With simulated chagrin, Chaz added, 3,000 square miles and they couldn't find a damn thing." "Oh, they found something," Rolvag said, freezing Chaz with one hand on the knob. 4 bales of marijuana. That's it." Chaz waited for the rush of nausea to subside. "Whoop-de-doo," he said. "I'm sure they're scared shitless down in Colombia." "Actually, the stuff was Jamaican, but you're right, they'll never figure out who dumped it or even where. The Gulf Stream probably dragged it all the way up from the islands." Chaz snorted. "From Bermuda, maybe, not Jamaica." "What do you mean?" "The Gulf Stream? It flows from north to south." Rolvag's blonde eyebrows crinkled. "Not the last time I was out there," he said. "I'm pretty certain it goes the other way, Mr. Perrone. To the north." Chaz lapsed into an unplanned coughing jag. What if the lame-ass detective isn't wrong, he wondered despondently. That meant the ocean currents had carried Joey's body from the remote perimeter of the search and rescue zone into the bullseye. "Heck, you might be right," Chaz cleared his throat. "My brain's so scrambled today I couldn't tell the sun from the moon." "I understand completely. You get some rest," Rolvag said, and headed out to his car. Chaz shut the door and leaned wearily against it. Of the millions of people who weren't sure which direction the Gulf Stream ran, he was probably the only one to hold an advanced degree in a marine science. He had a fleeting urge to phone one of his former professors and settle the question, but that would have invited scorn that Chaz was in no mood to suffer. It was one of those rare times that he regretted having been such a slacker in school. Quickly, he returned to the chore of removing his late wife's belongings, consoling himself with the knowledge that sharks off the coast of Miami Beach were as indiscriminate in their feeding habits as the ones in the Keys. Joey undoubtedly had been gobbled by one, the strongest evidence being the absence of a corpse. When Rika phoned, though, Chaz couldn't restrain himself from asking, "Honey, which way does the Gulf Stream go? Is this a quiz? What are my choices?"
"North or south," Chaz said.
"I got no idea, baby."
"Shit."
"Well, don't get mad at me," Rika said. "Aren't you the one supposed to be the big shot scientist?"
which is exactly what Carl Rovog was thinking about Charles Perrone on the way to the Coast Guard station. Corbett Wheeler had moved to New Zealand at the age of 22, believing that if he stayed in America, he'd spend the rest of his youth battling to hide his inheritance from his gummy-fingered aunt. Corbett had begged his younger sister to flee the States with him, but Joey's heart had been set on Florida. He had not been surprised when she married Benjamin Middenbach, but he was astounded when the stockbroker proved to be an upright, honest fellow with no overt interest in Joey's money. It was only later, after Benny had been flattened by the skydiver, that Corbett learned his sister had never educated her adoring husband about the family fortune. Corbett then began to suspect that Joey could take care of herself. By that time, he'd grown to love New Zealand, which was as vast and glorious as California, though without the motoring hordes. He had developed an improbable interest in sheep farming during a period when the East Frisian breed was being introduced from Sweden. East Frisians were the most prolific milking sheep in the world, and crossbreeding with New Zealand strains produced a bounty of chubby, fuzzy lambs. Corbett Wheeler had done very well for himself, though profit had never been a motive. He simply possessed an innocent fondness for the husbandry of sheep. Nothing gave him more joy than sitting on the porch of his farmhouse, toking on a joint, and gazing out upon verdant slopes speckled in pewter with rams, ewes, and lambs. One night, Joey had called excitedly to report that their late mother's twin sister, the avaricious harpy who had raised them, was being sent to prison for authoring fraudulent insurance claims. Dottie Babcock had been working in Los Angeles as a professional accident victim, racking up two or three imaginary collisions per month in league with a crooked physician. For every alias used by Dottie Babcock, there was a corresponding crushed vertebra, shattered hip, or detached retina. A newspaper had tracked her down and plastered on the front page a photograph of her rollerblading with her Pilates instructor in Santa Monica. Authorities had been obliged to take action, and a judge slapped Dottie with 8 to 12 years. Joey had delivered this bulletin in the hope that her brother might consider a return to the States, but Corbett had declined. From such a distance, and filtered through the leery eye of the BBC, American culture appeared increasingly manic and uninviting. Moreover, Corbett Wheeler couldn't imagine a life without lambing. He had come back only once for Benjamin Middenbach's funeral and had lasted barely 48 hours. The blinding vulgarity of South Florida was too much, total sensory overload. Corbett had flown home to Christchurch, resolved to hunker down and tend his flock. He spoke regularly to his sister, and in that way had learned of her growing doubts as to the faithfulness and rectitude of her second husband, Dr. Charles Perrone. Still, Joey had said nothing in those conversations that even hinted she feared for her safety.
"He actually pushed you off his ship?" Corbett Wheeler's hand was shaking as he gripped the telephone. "How? And why, for God's sake?"
Joey told him the story of what had happened that night. He managed to laugh when she got to the part about the bale of grass.
"Who found you? The DEA?"
"Not even close."
"But you've been to the police, right?"
No reply.
"Joey, what's going on?"
"It would be my word against Chaz's," she said. "And he's a good actor, Corbett. Better than me." Corbett Wheeler thought about that for a few moments.
"So, is there a plan?" he asked.
"There will be. I might need your help."
"You name it," he said. "Where are you now?"
"On some island," she said.
"Oh, that's terrific. Are you alone?"
"I'm staying with the man who rescued me."
"Aw, Joey, come on. I trust him," she said.
"You trusted Chaz, too," Corbett Wheeler said. "I'm chartering a jet first thing in the morning."
"No, not yet. Please."
His little sister had her weak moments, Corbett knew, but deep down she was a tough cookie.
"What exactly are you up to?" he asked.
After Joey got off the phone, she went outside and found Mick Stranahan fishing from the seawall, Strom dozing at his side.
How soon can Chaz have me declared legally dead, she asked. We're talking what, weeks? Months? When there's no corpse, I mean.
State law says 5 years, Stranahan said. Joey was glad to hear it, although she didn't intend to spend that much time stalking an asshole husband. She was looking for something quick and dirty.
Corbett is calling the sheriff's office, she said, to tell them it wasn't a suicide or an accident.
You want the cops leaning on Chaz so soon?
The more, the merrier. Besides, they can't prove he did it. You said so yourself.
Now, without your testimony, they probably can't.
So they'll just ask lots of questions and make him a nervous wreck, which is fine by me.
Him lying awake every night wondering what's next, Stranahan said.
Yeah, exactly. Staring at the ceiling.
But then how does it finally end?
I'm not sure, Joey said. You got any nifty ideas?
I'll bet you do.
Stranahan reeled in a snapper and tossed it in the bucket. He said,
You're entitled to some hard feelings. The guy tried to kill you, after all.
Mostly, I need to find out why, Joey said. Whatever else happens with Chaz, I can't walk away until I know the reason he did it. Did I mention he was younger than me?
No.
By almost 5 years. Big mistake, marrying an arrested adolescent.
She paused, worrying about one possible implication of what she'd said.
Pointedly, she added, That doesn't mean I'm going to suddenly start dating older guys.
Oh, darn my luck. Stranahan never took his eyes off the water.
Joey frowned. Sarcasm is not attractive. Chaz specialized in it.
Grand larceny isn't exactly my idea of a turn-on, either.
What?
You stole my boat, remember?
For heaven's sake, Joey said. She was trying to lay down a few simple rules, that's all. She didn't want Stranahan to get the wrong idea about their relationship. The cornerstones of her revamped approach to men would be candor and clarity. And Stranahan was the first test case. Mick, I want to pay you for your help. Plus expenses, of course, including room and board.
I still can't promise I won't try to sleep with you, he said. That's how I often behave when I meet someone attractive. It's only fair you should know.
I appreciate the honesty. I do.
Don't worry. You'll see me coming about a mile away. I'm not real slick.
No?
French wine, moonlight, and Neil Young. Strictly acoustic. Don't laugh. I know it's hokey.
Depends on the wine. Joey said. She was remembering the way he'd kissed her hand while the Coast Guard spotter was eyeballing them from the helicopter. She was wondering if it had been more than a show.
Stranahan said, If you were my sister...
Or daughter.
Christ, I'm not that old.
Go on, Joey said.
If you were my sister, honestly, I'd tell you to get your butt off this island as fast as possible.
Because
for all you know, he said, I could be president of the Ted Bundy fan club. I could be a serial killer slash rapist slash fill in the blank.
Now you're just trying to sweet talk me, Joey drawled.
Stranahan pulled in another snapper and declared they had plenty for supper. He got up and whistled for Strom to follow him to the fish cleaning table. He loves to hassle the gulls, Stranahan said.
You eat fish every night?
No. Sometimes it's lobster, sometimes stone crabs.
You don't get lonely out here? Joey asked.
Makes up for all the years of foolish companionship.
Stranahan unsheathed a narrow curved knife and went to work. It was a delicate enterprise because the snappers were small, but the blade was steady and precise in his large, weathered hands. Joey found herself watching with an odd sort of reverence, as if gutting a fish were some sort of mystic rite.
One night, maybe we'll take the skiff up to Key Biscayne, he was saying. There's a few decent restaurants.
Mick, do you have a gun? She asked.
This is Florida, darling.
I'm serious.
So am I. The head of the Miami Chamber of Commerce used to keep a loaded Uzi under her bed, Stranahan said.
So the answer would be yes. I own a firearm.
Will you show me how to use it?
I don't think so.
Just in case Chaz gets wise?
It's too dangerous.
Okay, Joey thinking. A half-wit baboon could learn how to shoot.
What exactly does your husband do for a living? Stranahan asked.
I told you he's a biologist.
But doing what?
He works on the Everglades project for the State Water Management District.
He any good? Stranahan asked.
I wouldn't know. Science is another universe to me, Joey said. I was the jock in the family.
What do they pay him?
Stranahan tossed a handful of fish entrails into the water. A gull dove on the splat, ignoring Strom's fevered barking. Joey said, Chaz's salary is $62,000 a year. The only reason I know is because he got audited by the IRS.
Can he get to your money?
This is important.
She assured Stranahan that her inheritance was safe.
And Chaz signed a prenup anyway. Every so often he'd hint around like he wanted me to tear it up, but eventually he gave up.
Doesn't that seem strange?
No, because he had a nest egg of his own.
I didn't pry, Joey said.
Because he didn't pry. Money wasn't a huge issue in our marriage, if that's what you're getting at. We split the bills down the middle, filed separate tax returns.
Money is an issue in every marriage, Joey. Ask any divorce lawyer.
Stranahan lobbed a glistening fish skeleton into the basin. It sank slowly in a wisp of crimson.
Are Chaz's parents rich? He asked.
His dad was the greenskeeper at a country club in Panama City, Joey said. He gets sick from all the pesticides and went insane, is what Chaz told me. Woke up one day and decided he was General William Westmoreland. Drove down to the docks and attacked a shrimp boat with a ping putter and a bunker rake. The captain and the crew were Vietnamese immigrants.
Whoa! Chaz told you this?
Joey nodded. He saved the newspaper clippings. Bottom line, his father is institutionalized. His mother works at Target, and she's remarried to a retired fighter pilot from England.
So where did Chaz's nest egg come from?
Stranahan had finished cleaning the fillets and was hosing off the table.
Is he a big spender?
Not usually, Joey said. But like 3 months ago, he went out and bought a brand new Hummer H2. Not financed, bought. Bright yellow, too. Said he needed a four-wheel drive for his field work out in the swamps.
Stranahan chuckled. Beautiful.
When I asked how much it cost, he kind of snapped, Joey recalled. And I wasn't nagging. I was just curious about what he spent. The same way he's curious when I come home with a new dress or a pair of shoes. But this time he told me to mind my own goddamn business. Called me a nosy bitch.
What'd you do?